This podcast contains sensitive topics such as murder, violence, and sexual abuse.
All right. Happy Thursday, everyone. We're going to be talking suspects. Why are you giving me that look?
All right, everybody. It's Thursday. We're going to be talking suspects. You know it's Monday, right?
Oh my God.
Happy Monday.
Okay, so a bit of a confession. We had actually recorded this episode last week, but I forgot to change my audio settings to my microphone. So when I went to edit it, Lindsay sounded like perfect and clear, and then my audio was like, woo, 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 woo. So,
not the kind of party you want to go to.
Right. So that's pretty much why everyone's going through withdrawals right now. Being like, when is the next episode going to drop? They did a whole toast and they said that they were recording it and it never dropped. That's what I imagine people are saying about
it. At least we're recording something though. Like, what if we just completely disappeared?
Right. They just ghosted everyone. We were just like, that was a fun
hobby. We get sued.
Oh God. Don't even joke about getting sued.
JK.
My biggest fear.
I'm not afraid.
I wouldn't be afraid either because there's literally nothing I could offer anyone.
I would just, never mind. I was going to make an inappropriate joke.
I'm glad you're starting to catch yourself when you're like about to make an inappropriate joke.
That, I was
like,
going to say, I just end my life.
Why did you say it anyways?
I feel like it's going to get edited out. It's fine.
But I'm the one editing it out. So now I'm not going to edit it out.
Okay, here, we'll start over. All right.
Oh man, I can already feel this one being like voted as like the least, you know.
Who's voting? I think it's just us voting.
I think all of our fans are just going to stop at the beginning of this one.
We did have a fan ask when we're going to drop this episode. They're like, can you please?
Yeah, that makes me really happy. I know that we probably have a total of like 28 people that listen consistently,
including us.
Yeah, I feel like I take like 17 of those.
I think 28 is a overestimation.
No, I can think about 28 people. I don't know about you. Do you know 28 people?
I know Maddie. Maddie is watching, Mike is watching, and that's it. No one else from my family is listening.
You mean listening?
That's what I said. Listen,
it doesn't really, like, nothing really matters as long as Maddie listens and still thinks I'm cool. Yeah. Revolutionary.
Okay. That's a stretch. That's another, you are like seriously overestimating today.
I think you're just butthurt because Maddie's one of the coolest people in your family and you're like number six.
Am I? There's only like 5 people in my family. Well, I guess if you count my mom.
Yeah, but your mom's cooler than you.
Oh my God. You know, I mean, she doesn't listen to this, so you're not even like scoring points.
It's okay. She knows how I feel.
Oh my God.
We've talked about it enough. Anyways, suspects. So we're going to talk about suspects. We shortened the list. Obviously, there are, you know, so many, but I kept it to suspects that have not yet been completely ruled out by the police department and Lou Smith and his family.
I thought the police department only focused on the family and didn't interview anybody else or even check on any other suspects.
No, that would be ABC. But that is something. Like, I know that there's a big misconception that the police only looked at the Ramseys, and I understand that it must have felt that way back then. But we do know now that the police had, hundreds of suspects and looked into countless leads. So we're going to be focusing on the ones that aren't 100% cleared. They can kind of just be theorized about. We're going to stick with people outside of the family because we're going to get into the family in the next episode when we talk about theories.
Right.
Which is going to be a couple of episodes, I think, because I want to cover like all theories.
I think we should do one theory per episode, like do the intruder theory, then do the pineapple theory, then, you know.
Right. Yeah.
The JonBenet's still alive theory.
As long as I can add in my conspiracy theories.
Yeah, that's what fine. I see. Yeah, that would be one of them.
Yeah. Jeez.
That's horribly offensive to that family. But
I know, but there are many conspiracy theories like around this.
What's more offensive to the family? The theory that they murdered their daughter or the theory that their daughter is still alive making TikToks?
And is Katy Perry.
Yeah, seriously. Like, I don't know which one is considered. I know which one is considered more offensive.
Actually. I don't know. Regardless of what happened, I do feel low-key bad that in the 20, you know, 4 years since it happened, like, not only were the Ramseys, like, you know, dragged publicly, even if that might not be justified, or if even if it is, we don't know. But on top of that, they had to deal with conspiracy theories claiming that JonBenet is world-renowned pop star Katy Perry, which, honestly, Katy Perry being my child is, like, already terrible enough to me.
Ugh, moving on immediately.
Yeah.
So, okay, so let's start
suspects.
With our first suspects, you can go first.
So before we start, because I realized this when I was driving around today, so one thing that I want the listeners to know before we dive into the suspects, and it's something we haven't talked about because honestly, I don't really know too much about it, is there is a theory about JonBenet had two marks on her side, and Lou Schmidt has said that that those marks are from a stun gun. The reason we haven't brought that up before is because, much like everything else, it's highly debated on whether or not it was a stun gun. So you'll read things where, you know, she was, you know, hit with a stun gun, and things where they're saying that the marks actually fit perfectly with Burke's train set, like
tracks.
Yeah. The railroad tracks. I bring this up because one of the theories, the first one we're going to dive into, talks about a stun gun as being one of the reasons that it's viable. So when we talk suspects, and we'll talk more about the stun gun during the theory portion, we've kind of ignored it because it's more part of a theory aspect than it is concrete.
Hard evidence.
Yes. Yeah. But just to make it even more interesting. So I will go first. So the two biggest suspects we have at first are Michael Helgoth and Todd Fuss. This was put forth by a 68-year-old Colorado woman. Her name is Bernice Johnson. She was locked up in Denver Women's Correctional Facility when she contacted the producers of a documentary titled Hunting JonBenet's Killer, An Untold Story. And within this, she claimed that her ex-boyfriend and also the father of her child, Todd Fuss, was JonBenet's killer. So this theory is compelling.
But you said she contacted the producers of a documentary?
Yes.
As opposed to contacting law enforcement?
True. Yes. And I would love to say that she's the first one and only one on this list that contacted a documentary crew over the police, but she is not the last one that we will talk about. Also, I mean, imagine getting that call as a documentary maker. Like, we're doing a podcast, and if someone called me up and was like, hey, I'd be like, you need to call the police, ma'am. Like, please get off the phone. Call the police. Don't call me. What am I going to do about it? Crack an inappropriate joke? And like,
oh my gosh.
I mean, like,
that's what I would do about it, probably.
Call the police. But anyways, so the thing that makes Todd Fuss immediately compelling is that he was a pageant dad, and his daughter did pageants that JonBenet was in. But according to Bernice Johnson, she doesn't think that he could work alone. So she name-dropped another person, and that was Michael Helgoth. And the next part is really compelling with this theory, and that's when the district attorney, Alex Hunter, made a press conference that basically stated that the killers, you know, will be caught, you know, you can't hide, you know, just doing that, that, you know, police scare tactic.
Of suspects narrows, and soon no one will be on there but you.
Exactly. Helgoth, the man that Bernice Johnson claimed was working with her ex-boyfriend, committed suicide the next day. So he was found dead in Boulder, Colorado, just a day after. And the thing that people really hold on to is allegedly next to his body, there was a stun gun. Additionally, there was a pair of high-tech boots found in his room. And as we know from the evidence portion of this podcast, there was a high-tech boot print in the Ramsey's basement.
So going back to the DA press conference from 1997, what was interesting is in Stephen Thomas's book, they were actually not really getting anywhere with other suspects. And, you know, the police were really wanting to focus on the family, but they were being blocked from getting a lot of the basic evidence that you would be allotted. He talked to Alex Hunter and was like, hey, we do think the family is involved. And Alex Hunter was kind of wishy-washy about whether he thought the family did it or not. And then he went on and uncharacteristically did this weird, like, hardball, like, we're going to get you thing that, like, no one was expecting. They said it was, like, so bizarre. Like, Alex Hunter, who's been so wishy-washy and unsure, gets up there and is like, we're coming for you.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, when we get into the theories portion, we'll talk a little bit more about the events that happened after that press conference. But, you know, the fact that Helgoth, who was a loose suspect at the time, immediately killed himself afterwards is what people believe to be telling, and especially with the stun gun. So as we mentioned earlier, the stun gun does play a role in the theories. However, as looking this up, I didn't find confirmation that there was a stun gun next to him. So I don't know if that's part of a theory or concrete. I haven't been able to find the answer on it. So I don't want to spout that was, you know, cut and dry. But so John Kennedy, he was someone who worked with Helgoth. He also believed that Helgoth was responsible for JonBenet's death because he stated that one day Helgoth told him that he wanted to know what it would be like to crack a human skull. And then the next day, and I find this quote to be really weird, but according to Kennedy, Helgoth's, and I say this quote, prized possession went missing, end quote.
What was it?
It was a flashlight.
What?
Yeah, and I mean, I understand where he's getting at. He's saying that, you know, this guy tells him he wants to crack a human skull, and then this heavy flashlight goes missing the next day, and then later we find out that JonBenet had a skull fracture.
Potentially from a flashlight.
Yeah, potentially from, you know, blunt force trauma.
Yeah, but they've never, like, they didn't find her DNA on the flashlight. There's also, you know, people, the police even said that flashlight could have been left by the first officers on scene. Like, right. they don't know whose flashlight it was. I mean, that's, and, you know, the fact that this guy let his prized possession flashlight out of his, you know, sight, I mean.
Yeah, it was a weird thing to say. And the thing that makes it hard to look at these suspects objectively is that by this point, it's 1997, they have been hit with the news cycle a lot. So they know so much about this case. So
right, they're armed with so much information, like unnecessarily so.
Right. Well, then, so it gets weirder. Kennedy also stated that in late November of 1996, Helgoth said, and this is a quote, quote, me and my partner are going to make $50,000 to $60,000 each, end quote, and kept talking about a, quote, killer deal, end quote. So that's, again, that's like a really subjective. We don't know if, you know, that was really said or not.
So to explain this a little further, $50,000 to $60,000 each would mean if there was partners, it'd be between $100,000 and $120,000. The ransom note was for $118,000.
Right, exactly. See, this is just something I wouldn't look into that much. And again, by this point, they know how much the ransom amount is. Because my thing is that, like, you know, if it, what's the phrase? If it quacks like a duck, it's a duck or whatever.
It looks like a duck and quacks like a duck.
Yeah, I don't think two randos just magically guessed his Christmas bonus. But anyways, okay.
Yes, that's a highly specific amount. If they were just like a few transients, you know, or whatever they were, like, wouldn't they just ask for like 100 even or even 120 even?
Right, I don't know.
Like, why 118,000 and 15 cents and all that crap?
Right. Okay, so arguments. So we stated out like why they were suspects, and here are arguments to suggest that they did not do it. The first one being that for two unknown people, neither of their DNA were anywhere in the house. So Michael Helgoth, he was a guy with no criminal record, no documented history of violence. He never met the Ramseys, never gone into their house, and had absolutely
there was no link to them. Between exactly.
Yeah, and so Michael Helgoth, you know, when he committed suicide after the briefing and everybody got real suspicious about it, his family actually came out to say that, look, like, he was recently broken up with. His sister was diagnosed with terminal cancer. He was, like, listed as a suspect in this, like, high-profile case, or at least a person of interest. You know, it kind of, he had, like, a massive drug problem. It kind of sounds like it was kind of a perfect storm either way. And they swear it had nothing to do with being guilty or, you know, anything like that. Also, like, I don't mean to really, like, harp on... who was his name? Alex Hunter. Mm-hmm. But, like, I've watched that press conference. He wasn't, like, scary. He's not, like, a scary dude. So this idea that he just scared the living hell out of this, you know, in his eyes, criminal, into killing himself, it just seems really far-fetched. John Kennedy, the person who, along with Johnson, claimed that these two must have done it, also had, like, a really... like, he had some mental health problems, which they never specify on that, but he also was the type of person that kept getting involved with, like, murder investigations, and he was, like, a big, like, conspiracy theorist, and his views, or his stories about Helgoth changed drastically. On one day, he says the prized possession is a flashlight. The other day, he's saying it's something else. Mm-hmm. The timeline changes. So basically, they pretty much dismiss his claims because they just keep changing.
How strange.
Yeah, and for Bernice Johnson, that was another one that her story kept changing as well, like the timeline when they got divorced, where he was, you know, things like that. There was also, like, a rumored property dispute that started going around, and I won't, like, concentrate too much on this because it ended up being debunked, but someone had started this rumor. I don't know who. Presumably Johnson or...
or anyone. Who knows?
John Kennedy or, you know, anyone stated that there was a feud between the Ramseys and Helgoth over... some land in 1995, but that has been thoroughly debunked because, you know, the claim was Helgoth's father owned some land that the Ramseys were trying to essentially steal from under them for John's company, but the company was already built at that point.
Right, they were trying to procure it so they could build his headquarters there or something.
Yeah. So another reason they were pretty much, like, unofficially ruled out is, like, Helgoth's boots, he had handed them over to, like, they were handed over to the police by the Ramseys' private investigator, and they did not belong to the partial footprint. We know now whose footprint it is, and we'll talk about it later. This was something I found out while looking through the suspects list. I didn't realize they had known definitively who it was, but we'll get more into that because I don't want any spoilers, you know?
Interesting. So if we move on to the next guy that, I mean, this guy is a real piece of work. His name's John Mark Carr. And he was basically ended up being a huge clout chaser. He was arrested in Thailand in 2006, but then released 2 weeks later. And authorities around that time began to suspect that John Mark Carr might have killed her. Based on some emails that Carr sent to none other than a documentary filmmaker, Michael Tracy.
Yep. He was the second one that just really had to get out his woes to television producers.
Well,
and, you know, automatically to me, that's a red flag for both of them.
Absolutely.
Like, the fact that Boris Johnson and then this guy, like, thought that the best way to convey their concerns were, like, through these documentary people, it already like puts a red flag on the idea that they're clout chasers.
Well, this guy, he's not even just contacting them with his concerns. He's flat out saying, I am a murderer who committed a crime.
Right.
This guy, I remember seeing videos of this guy. He's just so strange. In 2001, he was arrested for child pornography and left the United States shortly after. Eventually, when he was arrested in Thailand, he told media reporters, I was with JonBenet when she died, and the death was an accident. However, he was flown to Boulder, Colorado to meet with investigators, and they found immediate holes in his confession.
Oh, yeah. I mean, and I'm sure he's not the only... I know that there were others who also claimed the same thing. But I know that once he got to Boulder, one of the things I read about it is that the police were kind of, you know, excited, thinking this whole ordeal was going to be done. And I guess, like, the first question that they asked him, and I don't know what it was, they were immediately like, oh, man, he didn't do it. And... I mean, that's a bummer because, I mean, I feel like it's the dream when you're dealing with a cold case like this. Or not, I don't know if it's cold, but an unsolved case.
It was probably cold by then. It had been 10 years. And also, that was the same time around when Patsy Ramsey died, was when they were apprehending him, 2006.
I don't know if they were, like, I don't know if they officially, like, closed the case, though, is what I mean. Like, when you put it into, like, the cold case files and, like...
Oh, when they put it into the freezer... Yeah. In the police station.
Yeah. But either way, I imagine it's every investigator's dream, especially working on a case for so long, for someone to just have a confession immediately. But they, upon, you know, talking to him, they were like, no, he's just trying to claim shit he didn't do. I also, like, remember at one point he had told the police that he, like, shot her or something like that, or poisoned her. That's what it was. He told them that he, like, poisoned her, but there was no, like, the toxicology report had already, it wasn't, like, poisoned. He had no idea what happened to her.
Bizarre.
So I think we should just, like, go ahead and dive right into...
Well, with Carr, the last thing I do want to say that, you know, besides his story just not making any sense, not aligning with the narrative at all, his ex-wife informed the police that Carr was with family in Georgia during the holidays in 1996 when JonBenet was murdered.
Can you imagine being that ex-wife? Like, do you think she was just like, oh, God, I had to, like, go tell them that he wasn't this person again? Like, can you just imagine the disappointment where it's just like, oh, stop saying shit like this?
It's like a child.
Yeah, right. Like, getting called into the principal's office because your kid lied about doing his homework, but instead it's your ex-husband who lied about murdering children.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So the next suspect we're gonna talk about is probably like a world favorite, maybe. Like, this is this suspect is the one that everyone talks about, and every documentary at least hints about it at some point, and that is Bill McReynolds, better known in the true crime community and in followers of the JonBenet case as Creepy Santa.
Or Santa Bill.
That is such a mean name.
Creepy Santa. I don't know. I don't think I've heard. I usually hear him referred to as Santa Bill, but they do it in like a mocking way.
Yeah. I don't know. Whenever I guess I'm speaking mostly on, you know, Facebook comment threads that I become addicted to for some reason, where everyone's like, what about Creepy Santa? Can't rule out Creepy Santa.
They ruled him out over and over, and the DA even told them, go look at him again, because they just refused to believe the parents were involved.
So, I don't know about anyone listening, but Lindsay and I have really, like, we're really sad over the suspect, because we don't want to talk about what we believe in with this case, but there's one thing I am comfortable stating, and that is that I don't think Bill McReynolds had anything to do with it, and I actually think it's unbelievably sad how much his family has to go through with every documentary that comes out, every podcast, every, you know, Reddit blog thread. You know what I mean? Like, his name gets dragged more than any other suspect on this.
Well, it's tragic that it's literally ruined his life.
Yeah, and his family's life, because, you know, he is dead now. But let's get into him and why he's a kind of crowd favorite. So Bill McReynolds, he was older, and once he retired, he became the town Santa. And prior to, you know, the JonBenet case, everyone loved Santa Bill. I mean, he wasn't like just the Ramsey Santa. Like, he did like all of their rich friends' parties. He appeared on the local news a few times. Like, he was this cute little Boulder Town Santa that everyone, you know, hired and loved, you know. So, but, you know, he played Santa Claus at the Ramsey's Christmas parties in 94, 95, and 96. And that is obviously, you know, something that...
Gosh, you know, this is going to be so, like, off topic, but in your notes, you say Christmas Pirates.
I know.
Like, I was like, wow, that sounds really cool. He played Santa in the Christmas Pirates?
I know. I also just read that, and I chose to ignore it.
Okay.
So allegedly, he had wrote a note to JonBenet Ramsey claiming that she would receive a, quote, special gift after Christmas, end quote. Before we even continue, I keep hearing about this note, and I heard that the Christmas note was found by investigators in the family's home. Which is weird. So when I first heard about the Santa Bill theory, I heard that JonBenet had told a friend that Santa Claus was bringing her something special for Christmas. And then when I was looking up him as a suspect, there's now a note or something. I've never seen it. I didn't know that was a thing. So I'll look it up
heard
more after
in
this.
After, so 4 months after the murder, when the Ramseys finally agreed that all of their requirements were met for them to finally be interviewed. The interview, John Ramsey stated that, you know, Santa Bill or JonBenet said Santa Bill was coming to visit her or something on Christmas. And, you know, I kind of speculate that the conversation went something like, on Christmas Eve, JonBenet said something like, oh, are you coming to my house tomorrow? You know, which tomorrow would be Christmas. And right. She thinks he's Santa Claus. And he's probably said, oh, of course. And I'm going to bring you something special. You know, like, that's kind of what I speculate.
Have you heard anything about this note? Because that's the story.
I've never heard that.
Yeah. So the story that I've always heard and read about was that she had said to her friend that Santa was basically bringing her something special, which is not unusual. I'll double check where this thing.
But if you say it really slow and raise your eyebrows,
right.
Don't blink, he's bringing her something special.
Right.
So, I mean, that sounds like evidence right there to me. Like, did you see how I said it?
You have to let people know when you're being sarcastic, because I don't know if... No, because people can't see you.
Well, I'm being sarcastic. I will also say that the statement I'm referring to was from Stephen Thomas's book, and it was an interview. He was, I guess Lou Smith was the one who interviewed John Ramsey that day.
Oh, good.
Close friend of John Ramsey's by that point, actually. So, but that's where the statement came from. He's like, you got to look at this Santa Bill guy again.
So, yeah, I'll fact check the like a finding a physical note of it. I personally don't think it exists. I don't know where that came from. Maybe I'll bring it up in the theory episode again. But for sake of trying to be as factual as possible when talking about the suspects, let's just say that, you know, Santa was bringing her something special. It could be fucking anything, a bike, who knows. So another thing, people love to use the word like special about this.
Wasn't a bike.
I know, but
because they got her a bike.
Well, I know that, but she probably thinks Santa got her a bike because the Ramsey, like, she probably believed in Santa. And so even if the Ramsey,
it sounds
got
like
her
you're
bike,
speculating actually.
Okay. Well, either way. So another thing is people love the worthy special. They said Bill McReynolds had a special relationship with JonBenet, especially after she gave him gold glitter for his beard. So she used to do this thing where she would give him gold glitter. I will give everyone this one thing though. I do think it's weird that he was cremated with the glitter.
So he was cremated and then they mixed the glitter in by his request.
Right. That is a little bit weird, but not, I mean, something, it's not illegal to be creepy. And like, I guess I find that creepy. Maybe not everyone else does, but it's also not illegal to be creepy. And that's extremely subjective. So I don't know why people keep harping on it because it's not evidence. Like, people use that as evidence that he was, like, obsessed with her.
I don't think that's that weird, though. Like, I think it's a little weird, but keep in mind, JonBenet was, like, tragically murdered as a child, and he had, like, a bond with her. Everybody adored that kid that knew her. So, I mean, it's like, you know, yeah. I will always be touched by JonBenet, and I want to be, you know, cremated and sprinkled with her magic fairy dust glitter all over her grave. Just kidding. It wasn't all over her grave. That was a joke. But you know what I'm saying? Like, I don't think it's that weird. It's not like it was, you know, like you just met this random kid for like a day and they gave you fairy dust and you're like, I will be cremated and mixed with this.
I mean, like, that's a fair point. Like he knew her for years.
And she's forever like idealized, you know, by being like, she's like, what's the word? Like, cemented as this like image of a child that's perfect and never aging and tragically disappeared.
Right. Well, the thing, so another coincidence about Bill McReynolds is that 20 years to the day of JonBenet's murder. So it was December 26, 1986 or 1988 or something like that. His daughter had actually been kidnapped, she and her friend, and they were sexually assaulted. Or no, the friend was sexually assaulted.
In the car.
In the car. So, you know, people like to say that maybe this was a trauma response, you know, 22 years later or 22 years before, like, JonBenet was kidnapped.
That's like a well-thought-out crime. That is not a trauma response.
I know. Well, and, you know, to set the record straight real quick, it is a crazy coincidence that they were, you know, his daughter specifically and her friend were kidnapped on December 26th, you know, in the 80s or 70s or whatever. But Bill McReynolds didn't kidnap them. Like, somebody else did. So
yes, someone else was charged with that crime.
It would be more suspicious to me if he was arrested.
Right.
You know, because he kidnapped someone 22 years before JonBenet's death. Like, that's, like, more suspicious to me. But
the other thing is just tragic, you know? It's like, oh, his daughter was attacked. That's terrible.
Which could also explain, like, maybe why he felt the way he did when JonBenet died. Because, like, it could have been his daughter that happened to.
Yeah, it's, like, all over again.
Yeah.
But it wasn't his daughter's fairy dust that he was, you know...
We don't know.
...put his ashes with, so...
Yeah, well, she made it out alive, fortunately.
Wow.
I mean, it's true, though. Like, his daughter was very much still alive and unfortunately is still being haunted by not only that event, but by her father being a constant suspect in this case.
Being the daughter of creepy Santa.
And so far, pretty much everything we've talked about with Bill McReynolds is just subjective. Like, there's nothing in here other than people think that his actions before, during, and after were odd. Like, that's
But, like, the family's actions before, during, and after were perfectly acceptable.
Right.
But Bill McReynolds is odd. Okay.
So, this next point that people like to make, and this is my least favorite point, and this is the point that I will argue... As my like little true crime heart is that Janik McReynolds, who is his wife, 20 years before JonBenet Ramsey's death, she wrote a play about a child who died in a basement. So when I first heard this, was tortured and murdered in a basement. And so when I first heard this, I was like, yeah, that's like pretty weird. Like, that's so strange. And, you know, of course, when you're getting into you know, theories and you know, you have this perfect suspect. People like ran wild with it. I did more research, and the play that she wrote was about Sylvia Likens, which is, for those who don't know, Sylvia Likens was a child, a real child that existed, who was brutally tortured and beaten in the basement.
On a daily basis.
Yeah, on a daily basis. So essentially her family traveled with the carnival, I think, life, like the circus life. And they trusted a woman from their church to watch their children. And the woman had like serious, like kind of like alcohol and drug issues.
And she already had a bunch of kids. She had like four kids or something.
A lot of kids. So when Sylvia acted out, or I don't even know if acted out, but just being a kid, this woman would tie her into the basement and have the neighborhood kids. Oh my God. Like trigger warning, like majorly, but would have the neighborhood kids come and beat her and brand her and burn her and cut her.
Yeah, they'd put her in ice baths or scalding baths.
Yeah, so I mean, I don't know why Jana McReynolds.
She eventually died in the basement, right? Like that was the and she had a horrible years and years of torture. It was disgusting. Like the
it
way
was
that
so
woman
terrible. And
that
there's a movie, American Crime, that it's based off. So when you take a quick glance at the fact that Janet McReynolds wrote a play about a child's torture and death in a basement, you might be like, oh, that's so similar to JonBenet. Two cases are completely different.
It's already based on a case.
It's already based on a case. Yeah, so that it just drives me insane when people compare it, because this case already existed. It's already tragic. And the thing that made it such a popular case is that it was one of the first like trials about child abuse or, you know, things like that. So, you know, it's not that weird that someone made a play on it too, especially when there's a hit movie about it as well.
Right. People make plays and movies about the Black Dahlia, you know, like people make plays and movies about popular murders.
I mean, you and I are doing a podcast right now about the murder of a child. So like, I hope to God no one looks at me later and is like, well, you know, Sam did a podcast about this completely unrelated case. So now we're suspicious. All right. So let's move on here. Oh, okay. So let's talk about arguments that go against him as a suspect, because these arguments that go against him being a suspect are like actual real things and not just people think he's creepy. The first one is that Bill McReynolds had a very natural and very long white beard. And the idea that he could go through that entire house and not shed any hair is pretty unlikely. So they say that they found no hair fibers, no clove fibers from him. And that
no coal.
Oh my God, that was a good one.
No reindeer footprints.
Okay, you good?
Yeah.
Okay.
He was also fairly frail, although John Ramsey does say in multiple statements that Bill McReynolds was only pretending to be frail, but he had a weak heart. He had, you know, known heart problems, and
he had
a
plethora of health issues.
Yeah.
Like, he was the kind of guy that would have to go to bed at like 8 p.m. because he was in too much pain to continue throughout the day. Like, so, and please, if you're listening, look up a picture of this guy, because I feel like whenever I watch documentaries or anything and they bring up Bill McReynolds, they never show what he looks like. And I think the reason for that is because he looks so unbelievably frail.
Oh, yeah. He's like, yeah, because if you hear like, oh, Santa Claus crept down into the basement, and it's like, oh, yeah, he's creepy and scary. But then if you look at a picture of him, like he looks very elderly, and he looks, you know, like he would not be able to shimmy his way in through a basement window and, you know, carry a child. I mean, it doesn't really add up.
And navigate that entire house. It's just all.
Yeah, he sounds like he would be noisy as hell going upstairs. Like if you just look at him, he'd be like, oh God.
Like just coughing and like.
Yeah.
Although, when we get into the theories, there is a theory that suggests that JonBenet Ramsey let him into the house, but we'll get to that in the theories portion. They also, Bill McReynolds and his wife gave hair samples and writing samples to police. There was no match.
He had an alibi.
Yeah, they say it's not like a super strong alibi, because apparently being with your entire family on Christmas night isn't a strong enough alibi. But apparently, so he lived an hour away from the Ramseys, which is also something that is quite overlooked. And he had his, I believe, daughter over for Christmas. I think he had a son, but I'm not positive, so don't quote me on that one. Who both said that they were with them that night, and he and his wife went to bed at 8 o'clock. Again, because they are old people and it's Christmas. So the idea that he could have driven, you know, to the Ramseys after going to bed without anyone knowing is pretty unlikely. Especially because how would he know when they were going to be home versus when they weren't going to be home? And for someone who's a close friend with them, I feel like it would be easier to kidnap the child while she's like riding her bike. Or
also keep in mind, Bill McReynolds is very old. So imagine how slow he would be driving.
Yeah. I mean, that's speculative, but you're not wrong.
I'm just kidding, obviously. Well, you know, what really breaks my heart is like there's this point in Steve Thomas's book where he mentions that they have been told to yet again go and vet Bill McReynolds, and they go to his house to collect something. I think they'd already gotten their non-testimonial evidence and they'd already ruled him out at least once. So Stephen Thomas is going, why are we going to harass this guy again? But, you know, they were, you know, insisting they go do it. So they go there and they're pounding on his door, and he's, you know, they're literally, you know, intimidating so much that he starts sobbing, and he's like, I would never have hurt this child. Like, and his wife answers the door and she's all pissed off because yet again, they're here to harass Bill McReynolds, like, who had nothing to do with this. And, you know, it's just so sick. Like, you can picture him like all red faced and sniffling, like giving whatever thing they were there to collect. I mean, and Stephen Thomas just talks about how he felt really wrong about it. Like, he just knew, like, here we are following this lead that we've ruled out. Like, we're just wasting time.
Yeah. And so if anyone can take anything from this episode away, like, I don't know who people think did it, but please, please, please stop with the creepy Santa theory. It has been debunked. The family has been cleared. I understand that it's compelling, and I understand that it's interesting, and I understand that every new documentary that comes out about JonBenet Ramsey circles back to Bill McReynolds, but please take what we're saying into consideration. Think about it longer.
Well, even that ABC documentary that just came out that it seemed like Lou Smith's family was running it.
Yeah.
They bring up Bill McReynolds, but they don't focus a lot on how he was wholly ruled out. Like, they're like, oh, and Bill McReynolds, check this guy out. It's like, well, he was like ruled out more than once, like for multiple reasons.
I'm telling you, Lindsay, every time I watch a documentary, they all bring it up like it's the first time anyone has ever thought about this guy.
Consider this.
Like, every time. Every
time.
They
sensationalize it, though. It's like, oh, look, like, who better to sneak down and murder your child in their own house than Santa Claus?
Right, and it just, like, it really bothers me. I just want it to be put away. It's not a new theory. The police have looked into this countless times.
More than they needed to.
Leave it alone. Everyone, just leave it alone. Because it's, I feel like at this point, like, it's just such a scapegoat, and they can't handle it anymore. Like, no one's going to be able to solve this murder if they're constantly just looking at the same person over and over and over again. Like, he was cleared.
So speaking of looking at the same person over and over again, let's move on to Chris Wolfe.
Chris Wolfe. This is Lou Smith's favorite person. For those who don't know, Lou Smith is an investigator on the case. And
a friend of the Ramseys now.
Yeah. And his family, I believe, have taken over the case and, you know, things like that. So he's a really big proponent for the intruder theory. So, of course, we have to talk about Chris Wolfe.
So when you say the family took over the case, that's because Lou Smith is deceased.
Correct, yeah.
Did you know that Lou Smith visited, sorry, John Ramsey visited Lou Smith on his deathbed?
Yes, I did.
Wow.
I also like, and again, like, don't put much weight into this because I don't know this person personally, but I did get a message from someone on Facebook through our Facebook page that said that they grew up in Boulder, Colorado, and like knew, you know, when the Ramsey stuff was going on, and they actually speculated before he was even involved with the case that he was friends with the Ramseys, and they said that they have a, like, an eyewitness account of this. But I mean, that's, you know, neither here nor there, because it's not provable. But I thought that it was really interesting. So thank you to that person who messaged me. I had a very interesting conversation with you. I really enjoyed it. Whether it's true or not, we can never really know. But either way, I appreciate you reaching out.
Awesome. So Chris Wolf.
So this is very similar to Todd Fuss and Helgoth. Essentially, her name is Jacqueline Dilson. She was someone who worked at on a Dakota ranch, which was kind of talked about as like a small retreat slash conference center in Colorado, which was kind of like one of those new age places. She claimed that Chris Wolft moved in with her in her trailer in 1995 and was exhibiting strange behavior before Christmas, and it raised some concerns. So So Jacqueline Dilson reported her concerns to the Boulder police, which is wild. You know, I'm surprised she didn't call Ron Howard or Steven Spielberg. She actually called the police. And she told them that she believed that her live-in boyfriend, Chris Wolf, might have been the person who killed JonBenet Ramsey. But I guess the police didn't respond back to her, so she called Patsy's mother. And in turn, the police got back to her right away, which, that's wild that she had to go through Patsy's mother.
Look her up in the phone book.
Yeah. So according to Dilson, she had spent Christmas Day with Chris Wolf, and he would not stay for dinner with her family. So she says that somewhere around 10 p.m., she went to bed, and this is a weird quote, but she was thinking that Chris Wolf had gone off on, quote, a spree of some kind, end quote. I don't know,
like a bender, or like a, you know, drugs or alcohol, like what is
that? I assume it's something like that. Yeah, like gone out with some people, causing trouble. I don't know. I truly don't. But so then later the next day, at around 5:30 a.m., sounds from the bathroom woke Jackie up, and she realized that Chris Wolf was getting out of the shower and that he had left dirty clothes all over the floor. And without explanation of where he had been, he crawled into bed with her to go back to sleep. I'll get to how I feel about this later, but I'll just continue. Later the next day, Dilson and Wolf were watching the television news reports of the JonBenet's death. And to her surprise, she observed him being quite agitated. He began cursing and said that he believed that JonBenet had been sexually abused by her father. And for the rest of the evening, Wolf brooded over the case. Like, same. My family did too. Like, yeah. I had the exact same day. Like, when my parents, like, literally, like, I remember the day, like, the news broke out that JonBenet Ramsey died, and this is someone no one in our family had any idea who she was, but my mom was devastated, like, and, you know, I remember her calling her best friend Michelle Duda, like, on the phone, and they were talking about it. Like, that's not weird. Like, everyone
grew- Why would you say their full name?
That's not her real name. I used an alias. It's fine.
I think it would have been weirder if he was not agitated by this.
Yeah. I also, so one thing that immediately paints a red flag for me is that she specifically uses the times 10 and 5:30, like, so definitively, when we know that 10 o'clock is when the Ramseys got home and 5:30 is when they found their ransom note. So I just think that's a little bit too on the money. You know what I mean? Like, if she had said, I woke up at 3 a.m. because, anyways, I woke up at 3 a.m. and he was doing all that, like, okay.
Or 4:15.
Right. Like, just the fact that, like, both of those very specific times, which were now public at this point, That strikes a little bit weird for me. But another thing that's weird, and we'll get more into this in the theory episode, is there's a reason to believe that she died before midnight, so that her point of death was actually December 25th.
Wait, are you saying that because her tombstone says December 25th, even though the autopsy report says December 26th was her time of death?
Yeah, we'll get into that in the theory episode. But I have read different times of deaths, but the time of death definitely doesn't play to start at like 4 a.m., you know, because like...
Yeah, they literally plug your body temperature into an equation, and they base it on the temperature of the room as well. So they can pretty much pinpoint the time of death. The autopsy should have been able to...
Right. So already this account is a little suspicious to me, because this is basically implying that he went there, hung out at the Ramsey's house for 7 hours, and then went
or 5 hours, you know, because he, around, what did she say, around 10 at night, he took off or something. She noticed he was gone. Right. That's when the family said they were going to bed or whatever. So, you know, around 11, he gets in the house and then stays until, what, 4 or 5, and then leaves. Yeah, that's a long time to be in someone else's house. Like,
you know, like, exactly. And I don't know. That always makes me feel weird. There's like a gut feeling, like, just because those two specific times were placed make me feel weird. But either way. So, if you want, like, better evidence, I guess I can give it to you.
Well, here's some really good evidence right here. According to Dilson, Wolf hated big business and had a fascination with world political disputes and political violence.
How is he not in jail?
Seriously.
I mean, I think that enough is like reason.
Because John had a big business and he hated big business.
Yeah. I mean, I don't even think I know a single other person who hates big business.
No, I think Wolf is the only one.
Yeah. We're, let the record show that we are being sarcastic. That is not actually definitive evidence. I would just hate if we got off of this and our Facebook thing was blowing up being from people being like, oh, they solved it. It was Chris Wolf. There was no other explanation.
So Chris Wolf also had a sweatshirt with the initials SBTC, which was the signature of the ransom note.
Yeah, but it also stood for Santa Barbara Tennis Club. I don't know if the sweatshirt actually exists, though, because when I looked it up, because that's a pretty big thing, right?
Like, yeah, it's kind of weird.
I feel like police would be like at least a little bit like, okay, that's strange, because no one could figure out the initials. But I can't find any reference to this sweater. So I don't know if it's something they ever put into evidence. I don't know if it's anything like concrete or not. But also, too, that also sounds like something you could buy at a thrift shop. Like,
right, or it could just be a coincidence. Like, I just made up an acronym, AGFC. That's the Arkansas Game and Fish Commission headquarters. Like, I just made that up.
Well, and as we talked about in the ransom note episode, we don't actually think there was any meaning to the initials or the acronym.
Well, maybe it was the Santa Barbara Tennis Club.
Okay, but that makes even less sense.
And maybe all 8 of them were going to split the $118,000.
Oh. Thanks. So then later, on January 30th, Chris Wolf gets pulled over by police for driving with a suspended license, and they took him to the police station for further questioning, and I guess he abruptly told the police officer that they need to make better use of their time by chasing the killer of the JonBenet Ramsey case. And I guess that really perked their ears up, because they were like, why do you care? But honestly, that is something my dad would have said. 1,000%. If my dad was one of those people that if he ever got in trouble for anything, he would just turn it around on them. So like, I 1,000% picture my dad like drunk driving or some shit, and they're like, we're gonna give you a ticket. And I 1,000% could see him being like, oh, don't you pigs have anything better to do? Why don't you go solve this case that's going on? Like, that doesn't seem weird to me at all.
Well, Chris Wolf,
I was just gonna say, especially a case that was this popular.
Yeah, I feel like my mom says like off-color things like that all the time.
Yeah,
like borderline suspicious off-color things in public.
So one thing that is interesting about Chris Wolf, and one thing I personally can't debunk, his handwriting does look remarkably similar to the ransom note. And he has not been cleared as the author of the ransom note.
Yeah, I remember we looked up his handwriting sample, and it does look like the ransom note quite a bit.
Yeah. I mean, there were other samples, too, that we've seen that look just like the ransom note, but I'm not about to say that there's no way he couldn't have written it, because it does look remarkably similar, and handwriting experts, like expert analysis, couldn't clear him of not being the author. So what I find most interesting about Chris Wolf is that he sued the Ramseys because they included in their book that he was a possible suspect, and he sued them. He lost the case, wow. But he sued them, and he was pissed.
Yeah, because suspects like Santa Bill, like, they didn't have the financial wherewithal to stand up for themselves, you know? Yeah. So it's kind of interesting that, like, you know, Chris Wolf tried to, like, stick it to him.
Yeah, he lost the case, and, you know, maybe we'll talk more about that libel suit later, because I did find some interesting things about it. Because specifically from Lynn Wood, the Ramsey's attorney, who is just so wild. And a little spoiler alert for everyone, he's a huge QAnon conspiracy theorist now. Oh, dear. So that shows you that. But Chris Wolf did sue the Ramsey's. He was pissed.
So another thing to consider is, can you imagine being the Ramsey's if, you know, if they were not involved with this at all, and they have one of the suspects, especially one that their close friend Lou Smith thinks is a really legitimate suspect, that they're, you know, stuck in the court with this guy who they think, like, strangled and bashed the life out of their poor sweet child. Like, that must be awful to imagine, like, a family being faced with probably the killer of their child. But, you know, at this point, I mean, as it stands, Chris Wolf's never been charged with anything.
Right. Yeah. And I mean, I don't think anyone on the suspects list did it. I don't know who did it. I have more theories about what I think didn't happen. But as far as, like, Chris Wolf and especially Bill McReynolds goes, I don't see anything that's not subjective.
Right. There's not, like, oh, well, they found Bill McReynolds' hair in her nightstand or on her nightstand or something. Like, there's nothing that concretely links any of these people.
Right. And, you know, Chris Wolf, everything we've read so far is just suspicions by his girlfriend. You know, they're not anything. It would be a lot different if she said that he came home and, you know, had a broken piece of a paintbrush in his back pocket or something, you know, like, but there's seemingly nothing that truly ties him to the case other than maybe some wishful thinking on, like, the investigator's part. So next week, next Monday, I think is when we're going to record it. Hopefully we are going to be talking about the theories of the case. I'm very excited about this. And I think we'll probably end up doing more than one episode about the theories. Now that all of you listening are experts in this case, because you have listened to our brave analysis for 5+ hours now. So the theory episode should be interesting.
What's going to be our first theory episode? Intruder theory?
Intruder theory, always. Yeah.
Oh, great. I've been really wanting to, like, piece that one together, because I have a lot of trouble making an actual timeline, and I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, the intruder theory is hard. It kind of relies on the idea of a smoking gun somewhere that can piece it all together, but it's viable and it's interesting. It's something we need to talk about. Again, I don't know what I believe. Mm-hmm. I just know what I don't believe, but it doesn't. Right. None of that really matters. What matters is just, yeah, probably, like, trying to put in all the information that we can. And the intruder theory is obviously pivotal to the case and Lou Smith's work and, you know, stuff like that.
Yep. That's all I got. My bad.
Do you think Katy Perry will come on our podcast? Ugh. What?
Sorry, I mean to sound so tremendously disgusted.
Well, now she's not.
Yeah, really.
Way to ruin that, Lindsay.
Yeah, I know. You're welcome, everyone.
So, scratch our special guest episode. Katy Perry will not be appearing, probably.
Probably not. Well, I think that kind of wraps up the few major suspects that, you know, people tend to cite when they're convinced the family had nothing to do with it. It's entirely possible that there's some insane serial killer, or it's entirely possible that there's some weird serial killer or one-time murderer that isn't on the suspect list for whatever reason.
Yeah, or was maybe crossed out too early. I don't know. All I know is that I need everyone to, like, the second this podcast is over, to get Bill McReynolds out of your head. It did not happen.
Yeah.
Been cleared 100 times. Regardless of whatever hip new documentary comes out that promises new evidence, and they just come back to Bill and they try to claim it's a new idea. It's not. I promise you.
I've seen all the documentaries.
It's not Bill McReynolds. So how do you want to end things? You want to sing us off, or do you want to praise me? Do you want to say three things we both love about me? All right, I'll go first. I have excellent hair. I know that doesn't mean much from a podcast standpoint, but if anyone wants to look me up on Facebook, I have beautiful hair. I am extremely, extremely intelligent. And I'm funnier than Lindsay. So those are my three things I love about myself.
Well, at least one of those things is not true. Yeah. I like that you're such a good editor of the podcast.
Oh my God, are you actually going to do three things?
I love that you try not to laugh at my jokes, but you have to laugh at them because they're hilarious.
Oh, yes. And pity laughs. It's kind of like, it's the kind of laugh you do when you're uncomfortable, you know?
Like when you see a car accident.
Yeah, and you laugh. Yeah, exactly like that.
I think that was your joke last time.
Yeah, I don't know.
I don't know. And then I like that you have a really cute cat.
Only one? I have three cats.
Yeah, only one. You know which one.
My fat baby? My calico?
Yeah, of course the calico.
Obviously, yeah. All right, why don't you sing us off? Instead of singing goodbye, sing something else, like Forget About Bill McReynolds.
Okay.
All right, ready? A one, a two, a one, two, three, four.
It's not the time for Bill McReynolds.
That was good. I loved it. All right, goodbye, everyone. Thank you for listening. Please subscribe, share, become obsessed with us. You know the routine.
Listen to us on mute to give us the views.
Yes. Or listen carefully. Okay. Goodbye.